"All right," she said. "I can use a sheet off the bed. You shut your eyes."
"Why?"
said Gaspode. "For decency's sake." Gaspode looked blank. Then he said,
"Oh, I get it. Yes, I can see your point, definitely. Dear me, you can't have me looking at naked woman. Oh, no, ogling, getting ideas. Deary, deary me."
"You know what I mean."
"Can't say I do, can't say I do. Clothing has never been what you might call a thingy of dog what's-a-name."
Gaspode scratched his ear.
"Two metasyntactic variables there, sorry."
"It's different with you. You know what I am. Anyway, dogs are naturally naked."
"So are humans."
Angua changed. Gaspode's ear flattened against his head. Despite himself, he whimpered. Angua stretched. "You know the worst bit," she said, "is my hair. You can hardly get the tangles out, and my feet are covered in mud." She tugged a sheet off the bed and draped it around herself as a makeshift toga. "There," she said, "you see worse on the street every day. Gaspode?"
"What?"
"You can open your eyes now." Gaspode blinked. Angua, in both shapes, was okay to look at, but the second or two in between, as the morphic signal hunted between stations, was not a sight you wished to see on a full stomach.
"I thought you rolled around on the floor, grunting and growing hair and stretching," he whimpered.
Angua peered at her hair in the mirror while her night vision lasted. "Whatever for?"
"Does all that stuff hurt?"
"It's a bit like a whole body sneeze. You'd think you'd have a comb, wouldn't you? I mean, a comb. Everyone's got a comb."
"A really big sneeze?"
"Even a clothes brush would be something." They froze as the door creaked open. Carrot walked in. He didn't notice them in the gloom, but trudged to the table. There was a flare and a reek of sulphur as he lit first a match and then a candle. He removed his helmet and then sagged, as if he'd finally allowed a weight to drop on his shoulders. They heard him say, "It can't be right." "What can't?" said Angua. Carrot spun round. "What are you doing in here?"
"Your uniform got stolen while you were spying in the Assassin's Guild," Gaspode prompted.
"My uniform got stolen," said Angua, "while I was in the Assassin's Guild, spying." Carrot was still staring at her. "There was some old bloke who kept muttering all the time," she went on desperately. "Bugrit Millennium Hend and Shrimp?" "Yes, that's right." "Foul old Ron," Carrot sighed. "Probably sold it for a drink. I know where he lives, though. Remind me to go and have a word with him when I've got time."
"You don't want to ask her what she was wearing when she was in the guild," said Gaspode, who'd crept under the bed.
"Shut up," said Angua. "What?" said Carrot. "I found out about the room," said Angua quickly. "Someone called Edward de Eth," said Carrot, sitting down on the bed. The ancient springs went groin, groin, grink. "How did you know that?" "I think de Eth stole the gun. I think he killed Beano. But assassins killing without being paid, it's worse than dwarfs and tools. It's worse than clowns and faces. I hear Cruces is really upset. He's got assassins looking for the boy all over the city." "Oh, well, I'd hate to be in Edward's shoes when they find him." "I'd hate to be in his shoes now, and I know where they are, you see. They're on his poor feet, and they're dead."
"The assassins have found him, then?"
"No, someone else did. And then Cuddy and Detritus did. If I'm any judge, he's been dead for several days. You see, that can't be right. But I rubbed the Beano makeup off and took off the red nose, and it was definitely him. And the wig's the right kind of red hair. He must have gone straight to Hammerhock."
"But someone shot at Detritus and killed the beggar girl."
"Yes." Angua sat down beside him.
"And it couldn't have been Edward."
Carrot undid his breastplate and pulled off his mail shirt.
"So we're looking for someone else.
A third man. But there are no clues. There's just some man with a gun, somewhere in the city, anywhere. And I'm tired." The springs went glink again as Carrot stood up and staggered over to the chair and table. He sat down, pulled a piece of paper towards him, inspected a pencil, sharpened it on his sword, and after a moment's thought began to write. Angua watched him in silence. Carrot had a short-sleeved leather vest under his mail. There was a birthmark at the top of his left arm. It was crown-shaped.
"Are you writing it all down like Captain Vimes did?" she said after a while.
"No."
"What are you doing, then?"
"I'm writing to my mum and dad."
"Really? I always write to my mum and dad. I promised them. Anyway, it helps me think. I always write letters home when I'm thinking. My dad sends me lots of good advice, too. There was a wooden box in front of Carrot. Letters were stacked in it. Carrot's father had been in the habit of replying to Carrot on the back of Carrot's own letters, because paper was hard to come by at the bottom of the dwarf mine. What kind of good advice? About mining, usually. Moving rocks, you know. Propping and shoring. You can't get things wrong in a mine. You have to do things right. His pencil scritched on the paper. The door was still ajar, but there was a tentative tap on it, which said, in a kind of metaphorical Morse code, that the tapper could see very well that Carrot was in his room with a scantily clad woman and was trying to knock without actually being heard. Sergeant Colan coughed. The cough had a leer in it. "Yes, Sergeant?" said Carrot, without looking round.
What do you want me to do next, sir?"
"Send them out in squads, Sergeant. At least one human, one dwarf, and one troll in each."
"Yes, sir. What'll they be doing, sir?"
"They'll be being visible, Sergeant."
"Right, sir. Sir, one of the volunteers just now, it's Mr. Bleakley, sir, from Elm Street. He's a vampire. Well, technically, but he works up at the slaughterhouse, so it's not really..."
"Thank him very much and send him home, Sergeant." Colon glanced at Angua.
"Yes, sir. Right," he said reluctantly. "But he's not a problem, it's just that he needs these extra Homer goblins in his blood."
"No."
"Right, fine. I'll tell him to go away, then."
Colon shut the door. The hinge leered. "They call you sir," said Angua. "Do you notice that?" "I know. It's not right. People ought to think for themselves," Captain Vimes said. "The problem is, people only think for themselves if you tell them to. How do you spell eventuality?" "I don't." "Okay." Carrot still didn't look round. "We'll hold the city together through the rest of the night, I think. Everyone's seen sense." "No, they haven't," said Angua in the privacy of her own head. "They've seen you. It's like hypnotism. People live your vision. You dream just like Big Fido, only he dreamed a nightmare and you dream for everyone. You really think everyone is basically nice. Just for a moment, while they're near you, everyone else believes it too." From somewhere outside came the sound of marching knuckles. Detritus's troop were making another circuit. Oh, well. He's got to know sooner or later. "Carrot?"
"Hmm?"
"You know, when Cuddy and the Troll and me joined the Watch? Well, you know why it was us three, don't you?" "Of course. Minority group representation. One troll, one dwarf, one woman."
"Ah."
Angua hesitated. It was still moonlight outside. She could tell him, run downstairs, change, and be well outside the city by dawn. She'd have to do it. She was an expert at running away from cities.
It wasn't exactly like that," she said. "You see, there's a lot of undead in the city, and the patrician insisted that..."
"Give her a kiss," said Gaspard from under the bed.
Angua froze. Carrot's face took on the usual vaguely puzzled look of someone whose ears have just heard what their brain is programmed to believe doesn't exist. He began to blush.
"Gaspard,"
snapped Angua, dropping into canine.
"I know what I'm doing. A man, a woman, it is fate,"
said Gaspard. Angua stood up. Carrot shot up too, so fast that his chair fell over.
"I must be going," she said.
"Don't go."
"Now you just reach out," said Gaspard.
It'd never work, Angua told herself. It never does. Werewolves have to hang around with other werewolves. They're the only ones who understand. But, on the other hand, since she'd have to run away anyway... She held up a finger.
"Just one moment," she said brightly, and in one movement reached under the bed and pulled out Gaspard by the scruff of his neck.
"You need me,"
the dog whimpered as he was carried to the door. "I mean, what does he know? His idea of a good time is showing you the Colossus of Moorpork. Put me down." The door slammed. Angua leaned on it. "It'll end up just like it did in Pseudopolis, and Quirm, and..." "Angua," said Carrot. She turned.
"Don't say anything," she said, "and it might be all right."
After a while, the bedsprings went glink. And shortly after that, for Corporal Carrot, the Discworld moved and didn't even bother to stop to cancel the bread and newspapers.
Corporal Carrot awoke around 4 a.m, that secret hour known only to the night people, such as criminals, policemen, and other misfits. He lay on his half of the narrow bed and stared at the wall. It had definitely been an interesting night. Although he was indeed simple, he wasn't stupid, and he'd always been aware of what might be called the mechanics. He'd been acquainted with several young ladies, and had taken them on many invigorating walks to see fascinating ironwork and interesting civic buildings, until they'd unaccountably lost interest. He'd patrolled the whore pits often enough, although Mrs. Palm and the Guild of Seamstresses were trying to persuade the patrician to rename the area the Street of Negotiable Affection. But he'd never seen them in relation to himself, had never been quite sure, as it were, where he fitted in. This was probably not something he was going to write to his parents about. They almost certainly knew. He slid out of bed. The room was stifling hot with the curtains drawn. Behind him, he heard Angua roll over into the hollow left by his body. Then, with both hands and considerable vigour, he threw open the curtains and let in the round white light of the full moon. Behind him, he thought he heard Angua sigh in her sleep. There were thunderstorms out on the plain. Carrot could see lightning flashes stitching the horizon, and he could smell rain. But the air of the city was still and baking, all the hotter for the distant prospect of storms. The university's Tower of Art loomed in front of him. He saw it every day. It dominated half the city. Behind him, the bed went glink. "I think there's going to be..." he began and turned. As he turned away, he missed the glint of moonlight on metal from the top of the tower. Sergeant Colon sat on the bench outside the baking air of the watchhouse. There was a hammering noise from somewhere inside. Cuddy had come in 10 minutes before, with a bag of tools, a couple of helmets, and a determined expression. Colon was damned if he knew what the little devil was working on. He counted again, very slowly, ticking off names on his clipboard. No doubt about it, the Night Watch had almost 20 members now, maybe more. Detritus had gone critical, and had sworn in a further 2 men, another troll, and a wooden dummy from outside Cork Sock's Natty Clothing Co. And was the origin, long after the events chronicled here were over, of an Ankh-Morpork folk song scored for Tin Whistle and Nasal Passage. As I was walking along Lower Broadway, the recruiting party came picking up people by their ankles and saying they were going to volunteer to join the watch unless they wanted their Goohoolug heads kicked in. So I went via Peach Pie Street and Holofernes instead, singing To Rely, etc. It never really caught on. If this went on, they'd be able to open up the old watch house near the main gates, just like the old days. He couldn't remember when the watch last had 20 men. It had all seemed a good idea at the time. It was certainly keeping the lid on things, but in the morning the patrician was going to get to hear about it and demand to see the superior officer. Now, Sergeant Colon was not entirely clear in his own mind who was the superior officer at the moment. He felt that it should be either Captain Vimes, or in some way he couldn't quite define Corporal Carrot. But the captain wasn't around, and Corporal Carrot was only a corporal, and Fred Colon had a dreadful apprehension that when Lord Vetinari summoned someone in order to be ironical at them and say things like, "Who's going to pay their wages, pray?" it would be him, Fred Colon, well and truly up the Ankh, without a paddle. They were also running out of ranks. There were only 4 ranks below the rank of sergeant. Nobby was getting stroppy about anyone else being promoted to corporal, so there was a certain amount of career congestion taking place. Besides, some of the watch had got it into their heads that the way you got promoted was to conscript 6 other guards. At Detritus's current rate of progress, he was going to be High Supreme Major General by the end of the month. And what made it all strange was that Carrot was still only a... Colon looked up when he heard the tinkle of broken glass. Something golden and indistinct crashed through an upper window, landed in the shadows, and fled before he could make out what it was. The watch house door slammed open, and Carrot emerged, sword in hand. "Where did it go? Where did it go?"
"Dunno. What the hell was it?"
Carrot stopped. "Not sure," he said.
"Carrot?"
"Sarge?"
"I should put some clothes on if I was you, lad."
Carrot stayed looking into the pre-dawn gloom. "I mean, I turned around, and there it was, and..." He looked down at the sword in his hand as if he hadn't realised that he was carrying it.
"Oh, damn," he said.
He ran back to his room and grabbed his breeches. As he struggled into them, he was suddenly aware of a thought in his head, clear as ice. "You are a pillock. What are you? Picked up the sword automatically, didn't you? Did it all wrong. Now she's run off, and you'll never see her again." He turned. A small grey dog was watching him intently from the doorway.
Shock like that, she might never change back again, said his thoughts. Who cares if she's a werewolf? That didn't bother you until you knew. Incidentally, any biscuits about your person could be usefully thrown to the small dog in the doorway, although, come to think of it, the chances of having a biscuit on you right now are very small, so forget you ever thought it. Blimey, you really messed that up, right? Thought Carrot. Woof, woof, said the dog. Carrot's forehead wrinkled. It's you, isn't it? He said, pointing his sword.
Me? Dogs don't talk, said Gaspode hurriedly. Listen, I should know, I am one.
You tell me where she's gone right now, or...
Yeah, Luke, said Gaspode gloomily. The first thing I remember in my life, right, the first thing was being thrown into the river in a sack with a brick. Me. I mean, I had wobbly legs and a humorously inside-out ear. I mean, I was fluffy. Okay, right, so it was the ankh. Okay, so I could walk ashore. But that was the start, and it ain't never got much better. I mean, I walked ashore inside the sack, dragging the brick. It took me 3 days to chew me way out. Go on, threaten me.
Please, said Carrot. Gaspode scratched his ear.
Maybe I could track her down, said Gaspode, given the right, you know, encouragement.
He waggled his eyebrows encouragingly. If you find her, I'll give you anything you want, said Carrot.
Oh, well, right. If, right. Oh, yes, that's all very well, is if. What about something up front? Look at these paws, eh? Wear and tear. And this nose doesn't smell by itself. It's a finely tuned instrument.
If you don't start looking right away, said Carrot, I will personally... He hesitated. He'd never been cruel to an animal in his life. I'll turn the matter over to Corporal Nobbs, he said.
That's what I like, said Gaspode bitterly. Incentive.
He pressed his blotchy nose to the ground. It was all show, anyway. Angua's scent hung in the air like a rainbow. You can really talk, said Carrot. Gaspode rolled his eyes.
Course not, he said.
The figure had reached the top of the tower. Lamps and candles were alight all over the city. It was spread out below him. 10,000 little earthbound stars, and he could turn off anyone he wanted just like that. It was like being a god. It was amazing how sounds were so audible up here. It was like being a god. He could hear the howl of dogs, the sound of voices. Occasionally one would be louder than the rest, rising up into the night sky. This was power. The power he had below, the power to say, do this, do that. That was just something human. But this was like being a god. He pulled the gun into position, clicked a rack of 6 bullets into position, and sighted at random on a light. And then another one, and another one. He really shouldn't have let it shoot that beggar girl. That wasn't the plan. Guild leaders, that was poor little Edward's plan. Guild leaders to start with. Leave the city leaderless and in turmoil, and then confront his silly candidate and say, "Go forth and rule, it is your destiny." That was an old disease, that kind of thinking. You caught it from crowns and silly stories. You believed... you believed that some trick like pulling a sword from a stone was somehow a qualification for kingly office. A sword from a stone. The gun was more magical than that. He lay down, stroked the gun, and waited. Day broke.
"I never touched nothing," said Coalface, and turned over on his slab.
Detritus hit him over the head with his club.
"Up you get, soldiers. Hand off rock and on with sock. It another beautiful day in a watch. Lance Constable Coalface on your feet, you horrible little man."
20 minutes later, a bleary-eyed Sergeant Colon surveyed the troops. They were slumped on the benches, except for Acting Constable Detritus, who was sitting bolt upright with an air of official helpfulness.
"Right, men," Colon began. "Now, as you..."
"You men, you listen up good right now," Detritus boomed.
"Thank you, Acting Constable Detritus," said Colon wearily. "Captain Vimes is getting married today. We're going to provide a guard of honour. That's what we always used to do in the old days when a watchman got wed, so I want helmets and breastplates bright and shiny, and cohorts gleaming. Not a speck of muck. Where's Corporal Nobbs?"
There was a dink as Acting Constable Detritus's hand bounced off his new helmet.
"Hasn't been seen for hours, sir," he reported.
Colon rolled his eyes.
"And some of you will... Where's Lance Constable Angua?"
Dink.
"No one's seen her since last night, sir."
All right. We got through the night, we're going to get through the day. Corporal Carrot says we're to look sharp.
Dink.
Yes, sir! Acting Constable Detritus?
Sir!
What's that you've got on your head?
Dink. Acting Constable Cuddy made it for me, sir. Special clockwork thinking helmet.
Cuddy coughed.
These big bits are cooling fins, see? Painted black. I glommed a clockwork engine off my cousin, and this fan here blows the air over.
He stopped when he saw Colon's expression.
That's what you've been working on all night, is it? Yes, because I reckon troll brains get too war...
The sergeant waved him into silence.
So we've got a clockwork soldier here, have we?
Said Colon.
We're a real model army, we are.
Gaspode was geographically embarrassed. He knew where he was, more or less. He was somewhere beyond the shades, in the network of dock basins and cattle yards. Even though he thought of the whole city as belonging to him, this wasn't his territory. There were rats here almost as big as he was, and he was basically a sort of terrier shape, and Ankh-Morpork pork rats were intelligent enough to recognise it. He'd also been kicked by two horses and almost run over by a cart, and he'd lost the scent. She'd doubled back and forth and used rooftops and crossed the river a few times. Werewolves were instinctively good at avoiding pursuit. After all, the surviving ones were descendants of those who could outrun an angry mob. Those who couldn't outwit a mob never had descendants, or even graves. Several times the scent petered out at a wall or a low-roofed hut, and Gaspode would limp around in circles until he found it again. Random thoughts wavered in his schizophrenic, doggy mind.
"Clever dog saves the day," he muttered. "Everyone says good doggy. No, they don't. I'm only doing it 'cause I was threatened. The marvellous nose. I didn't want to do this. You shall have a bone. I'm just flotsam on the sea of life, me. Who's a good boy? Shut up."
The sun toiled up in the sky. Down below, Gaspode toiled on. Willikins opened the curtains. Sunlight poured in. Vimes groaned and sat up slowly in what remained of his bed.
"Good grief, bad," he mumbled. "What sort of time do you call this?"
"Almost 9 in the morning, sir," said the butler.
9 in the morning? What sort of time is that to get up? I don't normally get up until the afternoon's got the shine worn off.
"But sir is not at work any more, sir?"
Vimes looked down at the tangle of sheets and blankets. They were wrapped around his legs and knotted together. Then he remembered the dream. He'd been walking around the city. Well, maybe not so much a dream as a memory. After all, he walked the city every night. Some part of him wasn't giving up. Some part of Vimes was learning to be a civilian, but an old part was proceeding to a different beat. He'd thought the place seemed deserted and harder to walk through than usual.
"Does sir wish me to shave him, or will sir do it himself?"
"I get nervous if people hold blades near my face," said Vimes, "but if you harness the horse and cart, I'll try and get to the other end of the bathroom."
"Very amusing, sir."
Vimes had another bath, just for the novelty of it. He was aware from a general background noise that the mansion was busily humming towards W hour. Lady Sybil was devoting to her wedding all the directness of thought she'd normally apply to breeding out a tendency towards floppy ears in swamp dragons. Half a dozen cooks had been busy in the kitchens for 3 days. They were roasting a whole ox and doing amazing stuff with rare fruit. Hitherto, Sam Vimes' idea of a good meal was liver without tubes. Haute cuisine had been bits of cheese on sticks stuck into half a grapefruit. He was vaguely aware that prospective grooms were not supposed to see putative brides on the morning of the wedding, possibly in case they took to their heels. That was unfortunate. He'd have liked to have talked to someone. If he could talk to someone, it might all make sense. He picked up the razor and looked in the mirror at the face of Captain Samuel Vimes. Colon saluted and then peered at Carrot.
"You all right, sir? You look like you could do with some sleep."
10 o'clock, or various attempts thereof, began to boom around the city. Carrot turned away from the window.
"I've been out looking," he said.
3 more recruits this morning already," said Colon.
They'd asked to join Mr. Carrot's army. He was slightly worried about that.
"Good."
"Detritus has given them very basic training," said Colon. "It works too. After an hour of him shouting in their ear, they do anything I tell them."
"I want all the men we can spare up on the rooftops between the palace and the university," said Carrot.
"There's assassins up there already," said Colon, "and the thieves' guilds have got men up there too."
They're thieves and assassins. We're not. Make sure someone's up on the Tower of Art as well.
Sir?
Yes, Sergeant?
We've been talking, me and the lads, and, well...
Yes?
It'd save a lot of trouble if we went to the wizards and asked them.
Captain Vimes never had any truck with magic.
No, but...
No magic, Sergeant.
Yes, sir.
Guard of Honour all sorted out?
Yes, sir. Their cohorts all gleaming in purple and gold, sir.
Really?
Very important, sir. Good, clean cohorts. Frighten the life out of the enemy.
Good.
But I can't find Corporal Nobbs, sir.
Is that a problem?
Well, it means the Honour Guard will be a bit smarter, sir.
I've sent him on a special errand.
Can't find Lance Constable Angua either.
Sergeant, Colon braced himself. Outside, the bells were dying away. Did you know she was a werewolf?
Captain Vimes kind of hinted, sir.
How did he hint? Colon took a step back.
He sort of said, Fred, she's a damn werewolf. I don't like it any more than you do, but Veterinari says we got to take one of them as well, and a werewolf's better than a vampire or a zombie, and that's all there is to it. That's what he hinted.
I see.
Sorry about that, sir.
Just let's get through the day, Fred, that's all. A-bing, 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 a-bing-bong. We never even presented the captain with his watch, said Carrot, taking it out of his pocket. He must have gone off thinking we didn't care. He was probably looking forward to getting a watch. I know it always used to be the tradition.
It's been a busy few days, sir. Anyway, we can give it to him after the wedding.
Carrot slipped the watch back into its bag. I suppose so. Well, let's get organised, Sergeant. Corporal Nobbs toiled through the darkness under the city. His eyes had got accustomed to the gloom now. He was dying for a smoke, but Carrot had warned him about that. Just take the sack, follow the trail, bring back the body, and don't nick any jewellery. People were already filing into the Great Hall of Unseen University. Vimes had been firm about this. It was the only thing he'd held out for. He wasn't exactly an atheist, because atheism was a non-survival trait on a world with several thousand gods. He just didn't like any of them very much, and didn't see what business it was of theirs that he was getting married. He'd turned down any of the temples and churches, but the Great Hall had a sufficiently churchy look, which is what people always feel is mandatory on these occasions. It's not exactly essential for any gods to drop in, but they should feel at home if they do. Vimes strolled down there early, because there's nothing more useless in the world than a groom just before the wedding. Interchangeable Emmas had taken over the house. There were already a couple of ushers in place, ready to ask guests whose side they were on. And there were a number of senior wizards hanging around. They were automatically guests at such a society wedding, and certainly at the reception afterwards. Probably one roast ox wouldn't be enough. Despite his deep distrust of magic, he quite liked the wizards. They didn't cause trouble. At least they didn't cause his kind of trouble. True, occasionally they fractured the time-space continuum, or took the canoe of reality too close to the white waters of chaos, but they never broke the actual law.
"Good morning, Arch-Chancellor," he said.
Arch-Chancellor Mustrum Ridcully, supreme leader of all the wizards in Ankh-Morpork whenever they could be bothered, gave him a cheery nod.
Good morning, Captain," he said. "I must say, you've got a nice day for it."
"Ha, ha, ha, ha! A nice day for it!" leered the bursar.
"Oh, dear," said Ridcully. "He's off again. Can't understand the man. Anyone got the dried frog pills?"
It was a complete mystery to Mustrum Ridcully, a man designed by nature to live outdoors and happily slaughter anything that coughed in the bushes, why the bursar, a man designed by nature to sit in a small room somewhere adding up figures, was so nervous. He tried all sorts of things to, as he put it, buck him up. These included practical jokes, surprise early morning runs, and leaping out at him from behind doors while wearing Willy the Vampire masks in order, he said, to take him out of himself.